Well, good day, and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we are back with another episode for you, including we've got Dr. Joe and Sam and Kyle and Chris Prutzman back joining us, so we'll get into the rest of the topic we're going to be covering. But of course, we have to talk to Sam next because she's really the most important person on the show.
Gosh,
and your internet connection's better again.
Well, it's a whole different internet connection. I didn't have any for a couple weeks, and that was, I don't want to tell you how many emails I haven't answered yet, but it's been weird here in the north, the Front Range of the Rockies. It's been very, very, I don't know what you would call it, misty, foggy. There's no sun. Maybe Kyle can explain that.
Hey, Sam, good evening to you and all the wonderful folks in Disaster Podcast land. Kyle Nelson, your friendly neighborhood meteorologist here. And yes, Sam, we are finally getting a little bit of that monsoon moisture to come into the mountains of Colorado, something that we have long looked forward to this very dry and dreary summer that we've been having here, and washing some of the smoke out of the air so I can finally breathe this evening. But looking back at the last week of weather around the world, it's been a heck of a week. So let's kind of start at the top and let's work our way down. We were talking a little bit before the show here about flooding and landslides and things over in India. Hundreds reported to have been killed so far with landslides, mudslides, and flash flooding due to insane amounts of rain that have been falling over there. And this is something that we... again, are seeing more and more around the world with these extreme events, especially on the heavy rainfall side. And, you know, we talk about these natural hazards and, you know, they truly are, you know, they are natural, but they become disasters when they impact the built environment like we're seeing over in India currently. Go ahead, Sam.
No, I was just going to say that's really brutal. I won't complain about the rain again. We've been lucky in that respect. We haven't had an overflow like they're having.
Right. We've been incredibly lucky, especially with all the wildfires that have occurred and are continuing to occur across the western U.S. and even up into Alaska as well. And with all those wildfires, of course, after they occur, and even while they're occurring, all that ground that has been scorched makes it those areas surrounding those burn scars very susceptible to landslides, mudslides, and flash flooding. And we've been very fortunate in many of the areas to have not had any catastrophic landslide or mudslide events. Thankfully, so far, pretty isolated little debris flows and things as, you know, for the most part. But of course, it's not just this season. It's going to be for many, many years to come until that area can become revegetated. Looking into Oklahoma now, the central part of the U.S., back on August 18, there was a thunderstorm that rolled through. It had some winds out in front of it, known as a gust front, at all that cold air that rushes down and out of that storm ahead of it that's cooled by the rain and things evaporating before it hits the ground. That impacted a line of people waiting in line for a, get this, Backstreet Boys and 98 Degrees concert. Be still my 90s heart. Oh my gosh. So, and this occurred at a casino in Thackerville, Oklahoma, and a metal structure blew over and fell onto folks that were waiting in line, injuring, it sounds like 14 folks. And of course, this just is a you know, really stark reminder that you don't need to wait for those official warnings or prompts from those local authorities to seek shelter. If you don't feel safe where you are, go ahead and seek shelter. And yes, I get it. It might be general admission seating, but would you rather be, you know, injured waiting in line for that front row seat, or safe and still be able to hear and see that concert in a good physical state? So just something to think about. And getting back to a little bit closer to home for me, Madison, Wisconsin, just last night, we had in excess of 15 inches of rainfall occur in and just west of Madison, Wisconsin. That's Dane County, Wisconsin, for those of you that are familiar. And we had one person confirmed dead. He was swept away in floodwaters and killed when his vehicle became disabled in high water. And he was trying to escape that vehicle. And just hundreds of water rescues and vehicles of all sizes driving down those flooded roads. And this happens again and again, and it still frustrates me because we're putting our first responders at unnecessary risk for completely preventable things. So like driving into floodwater. So turn around, don't drown. And last but not least, let's look into the Central Pacific because Hurricane Lane is looking like it's going to take a northern turn to head towards the Hawaiian Islands as we go on later into the week. So even if it doesn't make a direct hit with those hurricanes, impacts extend way far away from the center. That hurricane is going to slow down as it approaches the Hawaiian Islands. So heavy rainfall and sustained damaging winds, the biggest threats. Sam, that's a quick look at the disaster weather roundup. Back to you.
Oh, good grief. Actually, I think we've been kind of lucky, knock on wood, when it comes to hurricanes. But then if we remember what happened last October, we're hardly out of the woods, as they say.
Yeah, we're coming into, we're coming into the peak season with the hurricane season hitting
and approaching
here soon.
And approaching the one-year anniversary of Hurricane Harvey.
You bet. And all them that followed.
Yes. So it only takes one, folks. It only takes one.
That's it. So we got Dr. Joe, not in Memphis, but just a little north of us up there in Cheyenne, Wyoming. What are you doing up there, Joe?
Well, I'm in Cheyenne for a couple of days for the Wyoming EMS and Trauma Conference. Looking forward to a great conference up here and a few days in your neck of the woods, Sam.
That is awesome. We'll have to talk more about that. So it's funny, Kyle, you should mention that issue in Oklahoma because we have our resident Oklahoman, Chris Prutzman. Chris, what do you know about that concert thing?
Well, I think Kyle summed it up pretty well. It wasn't any surprise. There was warnings put out well ahead of that event down in Thackerville. And unfortunately, Thackerville exists about 20 miles north of the Red River on the Oklahoma side. So that's a rural community that doesn't have a lot of resources. And the casino that he mentioned is the largest, obviously, building, arena, anything in that area. So I'm sure that some of my my colleagues in Murray and Love County were quite busy that evening.
Yeah, no doubt. Sorry, I got it was shiny. I forgot what I was going to say.
Actually, Sam, it's a great segue into our topic because it is a rural area, and you know, it brought some resources, you know, in that could have been used for other things, possibly, you know, but had to be used for this situation.
And that's one of the points Chris wants to make. But Chris, before we jump in, tell, in case people haven't heard you on the several times we've had you here before, let them know what you do.
I'm the director of operations for Samaritan EMS. We are a municipal and DOD provider of EMS services, ground transport. We currently have four municipal contracts in the state of Oklahoma. And one DOD contract, as well as one DOD contract for an Army base in Pennsylvania. That's my primary responsibility. I'm also doing some development of tactical medicine programs for a local SWAT team and actually finishing up some education in the billing and coding area. So I kind of diversified a bit in the EMS business.
Oh, sorry about the barking pooch there. Well, let's start with the comment Jamie made in terms of, you know, resource utilization. Obviously, we don't have the kind of use or resources out in an urban rural area, and that's what we want to talk about tonight, as we would, you know, in town. So maybe using that incident as an example, how about that? What happens when you get something that really takes all your local resources out of service?
Well, it's kind of an interesting situation, especially in Oklahoma. And in that particular area, there's two county-based systems. My knowledge of them is they're probably running 4 to 5 units county-wide. So with an incident with 14 patients, assuming that you could potentially get two patients in every ambulance, and you might have to call in some air medical resources. And that area of Oklahoma doesn't have any real significant trauma resources as far as acute care. You've probably got a level 3 or a level 4 hospital there. So your closest trauma center is probably going to be Plano, Texas. So you'd be taking some of those patients and sending them across state lines. But, you know, obviously with that weather front, aeromedical may also be a challenge. So you're taking a lot of ground resources away on a mission time that puts them, you know, away from their basically home base for probably 3 to 4 hours until you make that round trip and come back. So, you know, those types of situations impact not only obviously the local resources, but I mean, you could span that a few counties north or east or west and really kind of put a damper on the entire response system in that region for several hours. And then that, I think, is one of the major issues that we're facing in rural EMS with those particular limited resources and resources just dissolving overnight.
Sam, did you forget to hit mute again?
Yes, I did. Talking to myself. Usually it's Joe that does that, so I'm trying to even things up here. Talking to myself again. But, Chris, using Oklahoma as an example, in a rural setting, how does the mutual aid work? What kind of mutual aid partners are there in terms of both response and transport?
Well, Oklahoma is a very unique situation. About a year and a half ago, the Oklahoma State Health Department made a decision that there was no longer what they called mutual aid agreements, physical signed, yes, we will respond. They turned that into a situation where they moved that to a kind of a letter that says, if we have the resource, we'll respond. And that has created quite a bit of deficit because you don't have to necessarily send an ambulance if it's going to deplete the resources in your, you know, local regulated service area. The other challenge that we face here, especially in one of the areas that I operate in, is we are currently the only 24/7, 365 paramedic level ambulance in that county. The other provider predominantly just downgraded their license from a paramedic level to a basic life support level ambulance. That community is about 20 miles southwest of the community that we provide for. And the next closest ALS resource is either 40 miles away to the east in another county or 36 miles south in another county. So those mutual aid situations, you know, really are very fluid, and it becomes a concern, obviously, because that ALS unit gets really busy with ALS Intercept and responding to other communities, and in the particular case of Thackerville, maybe getting pulled into that situation. So you're leaving your home turf, if you will, uncovered while you're helping somebody else. And that usually gets folks that are in the city government arena very excited when the resource that they are contracted with or are providing financially for is not there to serve their community. So it's a huge challenge, probably something that the lawmakers and, you know, rulemakers didn't think about when they wrote that.
Well, you're talking about one ambulance?
Yes, one ambulance.
Oh, my goodness.
The ambulance.
The ambulance. Don't even have any backup there. Jamie, I'll just throw this to you. You're in a rural area on the East Coast. How do things work? Is it similar there? You have the same kind of challenges?
Actually, I mean, we have written mutual aid agreements both at the county level in inside the state of Maryland, as well as mutual aid agreements between the state of Maryland and health departments in Pennsylvania, Delaware, West Virginia, Virginia. And those all allow us to cover each other, essentially. You know, gives us the license to operate with our state licenses out of state in those situations and vice versa. So that works in that sense. And we don't have the transport times that Chris is dealing with, where we're talking about hours. But it does deplete resources because the closest hospital from my area is about a half hour away. So any ambulance call from start to finish, we usually figure is about 2 hours by the time you get back in the station and restock. You're going to be an hour from getting back on in service at the very least, where you can respond to a new call. And so this pulls resources, especially after hours. And because so many of our services in rural Maryland are volunteer only, it can put a real drain on the system during business hours because people have jobs. And so only those few members that might have night jobs and are available during the day or are off that day can get the ambulance out. So there's some challenges in rural areas, and it comes down essentially to funding. Chris was talking about municipal areas paying for ambulance service. It's a heavily volunteer system here in Maryland. And so partly because the tax base just won't support a full-time ambulance service. But volunteer services put up by the fire departments are available, and they run entirely on donations and a little bit of tax money that comes in from the property taxes that supports both ambulance and fire service. And so I think it comes down to really funding. I don't think people realize, and we see this a lot in our area because people move out here from Philadelphia or up from Baltimore, and they are used to having a paid 911 service. And it's interesting to see the look on their face when they realize that their neighbor got out of bed and came and got the ambulance out to come pick them up. And they're like, what are you doing here? And it's like, well, didn't you know these are always volunteers that do this? So they're completely unaware of the fact that the system they've moved into is staffed and run in a different manner. And so I'm a big proponent of educating our public on what to expect when they call 911. What are you going to get when you call? Are you going to get a paramedic, or are you going to get a BLS ambulance, which with the basic service, and have to rendezvous with paramedics from another service coming in to help out? These are all things that the public doesn't understand. And so when these questions come up for legislative review and new laws put in, as Chris just talked about, it can cause some issues because people don't understand what the real issues are.
Wow. And Chris, I was going to ask you to explain, ALS intercept, but I think Jamie kind of did that using another term. But explain how that works. That's another thing a lot of people probably don't understand that you have to do in some situations.
With ALS intercept, I mean, it would be a basic life support ambulance, or in Oklahoma, we actually have an intermediate level licensure for the state. So it would be an EMT with some advanced skills, maybe advanced airway, maybe some IVs, that would be transporting this patient, but feel like they need the enhanced level of a paramedic. So maybe more pharmacology, more cardiac monitoring, something of that nature. And they will head the general direction of the hospital that they're going to. And if there is an ALS service along the way, they may call their dispatch and ask, them to contact that ALS service to meet them somewhere along the road. It gets really interesting at that point in time because we all know CMS has a very stringent set of rules. So do you transition that patient on the roadside to your ambulance and then you're going to bill for that? Do you jump on the ambulance that they're currently in and now that makes it an ALS ambulance? And can they bill at that level? So there's all these, kind of behind the scenes things that go on that nobody really has a good idea. As Jamie said, that this actually does happen. And then how do you manage that from a fiscal responsibility and do the right thing and not get yourself in a snag with CMS? So it's a really interesting and constantly changing, kind of situation, because as I said, these providers come in and out and the licensures change, and sometimes you don't find out about that until you're actually there with them and, they're asking for a paramedic and we're saying, I thought you were a paramedic. So, it's a very interesting time, especially in Oklahoma.
Well, we want to talk a little bit more about funding, and I think everybody has a good perspective. But Joe, you have a lot of rural areas in Tennessee, needless to say. How does your scenario differ or compare with what we've been talking about?
Well, I think we have a lot of similarities. I was fascinated by, you know, the comment of the elimination of mutual aid compacts for, you know, this different system, and clearly lots of unintended consequences of that, which in reality has probably made mutual aid support from surrounding communities much less likely to occur. I think certainly in Tennessee, we have aspects of everything that's been discussed so far and have taken many of the same approaches to try to alleviate the concerns there. I think about what was said in terms of disaster, particularly where my experience has been with smaller communities, more rural communities, where the leadership of the community, whether that's the sort of law enforcement leadership who seems to kind of be in charge in many of those situations, has extremely limited experience with large-scale incidents, doesn't really understand what resources are available from the region, the state, the feds, how to access those things, what to do with them when they show up in theater, and how to integrate them within their, you know, their own systems. And, you know, I can think of multiple examples where local elected officials didn't understand how EMAC systems work and how you would, you know, ask for help from a neighboring state or neighboring community. And I think that's, again, an unintended consequences of the people that get elected to some of these offices who we count on when things are, you know, going really bad, and who in reality, their agendas are have nothing to do with emergency preparedness or disaster response or being prepared to take care of a community in a time of need.
Wow, that's unfortunate. So, Kyle, you're more of a wilderness than a rural setting, or but what kind of situation do you have up there in the Rockies?
Well, Sam, up here in the central mountains of Colorado, I mean, we can definitely be in situations where mutual aid is absolutely essential, especially during ski season. If we have multiple ski patrols, have folks on the hill who are being injured and that require an ambulance transport to the hospital or even an evaluation by the ambulance, that's going to create a draw on resources. And as a result, our local ambulance service that's on the private side, they actually, during ski season, staff an ALS ambulance specifically for resort operations. Otherwise, throughout the valley, we operate largely on the volunteer side. There are some, most of our fire departments here are combinations, so both paid and volunteer, but there's only one crew on that can staff a single ambulance. So if there's multiple patients, you have, say, a big multi-car pileup or even a multi-vehicle accident with multiple patients, you're drawing those EMS resources then from multiple departments, as well as perhaps the private sector ambulance services. So that can get pretty interesting pretty quick. So within the valley here, at times I can count on one hand how many ambulances we could call upon if we're needed all at once. Sometimes we have, you know, an abundance. So it varies. And it's just something that we always have to keep in mind on the dispatch side of things as well is, you know, during the day, and, you know, if we have, you know, calls that are, for some of you that may know, say echo level or they're, you know, lights and siren calls, CPR in progress type things, that may trigger an automatic mutual aid response for us where we're automatically paging both the agency that's responsible and a neighboring department that has a mutual aid agreement with that service. So it's things that we have learned many lessons from and have good policies in place to hopefully prevent things on the negative side from happening in future.
Oh, good deal. You know, Chris, something Joe said kind of resonated with me about, you know, local city, county governments not caring about or not understanding the costs and the needs to keep an EMS system or a rural EMS system alive. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, obviously every, you know, scenario is different across the country. Specifically in Oklahoma, the county commissioners of every county are responsible for the, you know, well-being of the citizens, and they're responsible to ensure that there is EMS coverage in the county. And, you know, those gentlemen and ladies are fantastic with roads and bridges and agriculture, but as Dr. Joe so eloquently stated, sometimes they just don't have a good understanding of exactly what an EMS system is and what that takes to be able to run those calls, because obviously the call volume is not there to support it financially. So there's going to have to be some finances from other areas. We do have some volunteer situations here in Oklahoma, especially in the northwestern part of the state. They're having a lot of problems recruiting. So the county commissioners, I think, need to have a world of education. And we also realize that those seats change from time to time. We just had a situation in one of my operations, which we actually turned that over. We closed our base and turned it over to another local operator. And we went from a paramedic level service that we were providing down to a basic level service. That's the largest county, largest rural county in the state of Oklahoma. And at that point in time, when we unfortunately had to leave that contract, that left four ambulances in the middle of the county, all of which were now BLS, and there were two ALF level providers, which were both through the fire service, but neither of those ALS providers would leave their city. So there's an entire, you know, probably 900 square mile area in the middle of this county that basically has only basic level ambulance and limited aeromedical resources to respond to anything that they would need. So it's a really grave situation here, and I'm sure in other parts of the country. So getting those people to understand what it takes to actually do the job that we do is a monumental task, and sometimes we just can't achieve it.
Well, then you add long transport times to all of the above. Jamie, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think, you know, the challenge is to really educate the public and educate, and as a result, educate our lawmakers. In our area, we do that by regularly inviting our county council members to attend meetings of the chief's council and the EMS chief's meetings that happen once a month. We try to make presentations when specific issues come up, to let them know of challenges we face. And we do this trying to do it ahead of time so that we don't have that major incident, that mass casualty event, that significant flooding and water rescue that taxes the system beyond the limits of what we have available here. And then there's the public inquiry and outcry. And I think that's one of the things that are the most challenging for services in most cases, is people don't get upset about the job we do until they need us and we aren't there. And then they want to know why. And it may be a perfectly reasonable reason from our standpoint as to why we weren't available. We were covering a neighboring district and we're 2 hours down the road when the call came in. But they want to understand that. They may not believe that it is a valid reason, even though you consider it a valid reason. So it really comes down to educating our public and educating the people who are responsible for local government, so that they can be in your corner when things like that happen. And I think that that's something that a lot of services really drop the ball with.
Joe, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think he summed that up nicely. It's all about making certain that the people that control the purse strings understand the value of the services that are offered and the challenges of doing that efficiently. And
to some extent what they feel their responsibilities are, not only to their own community, but to the surrounding communities as well. And to some extent, you need sort of regional conversations about things like mutual aid and how are we going to take care of our neighbors and take care of ourselves at the same time.
Yeah, and you made a good comment too, Joe, about, and then there was Jamie, about educating the public and the people that will be responded to help understand exactly what kind of system there is.
And that's going to wrap up this two-part segment of the Disaster Podcast. This is part one, and we'll pick up with part two next week. We wanted to keep talking about rural EMS and talk a little bit more about some clinical topics. And so we will can pick up on next week's episode with Chris Prutzman and Dr. Joe Holly and Kyle Nelson and Sam Bradley and myself. So please come back for that episode. Before we go, I want to thank Paragon Medical Education Group for their continued sponsorship of the program. Remember to reach out to them if you're looking for some super customizable disaster and medical EMS training for you and your service. You can really find a lot of things are more affordable than you'd think by just reaching out to them and having a chat with them about what it is you actually want them to do. It's a customizable resource for you, and you should take advantage of it. So reach out to them at paragonmedicalgroup.com. You can also find links to them on disasterpodcast.com and over off of our Facebook group at Facebook. So please check in there. For Sam Bradley, myself, Kyle Nelson, Chris Prutzman, and Dr. Joe Holly, I want to thank you all for checking out this show. Remember to tune in next week for part two as we continue on in this discussion of rural EMS challenges.